This is a summary of the book Crisis of Character by Gary J. Byrne. The summary was written by CleanGov. Introduction. Gary Byrne was a uniformed officer in the Secret Service and for a time stood guard outside the Oval Office in the White House. He observed that the common foot soldier, as you might call it, in government service, was held to the highest ethical standards, while those at the top of the chain of command observed a much lower standard of what was right and wrong, or no standard at all, speaking about the Clintons. In any organization, morals and ethics and character start at the top and filters down from there to the rank and file. Byrne feels that Hillary lacks integrity and is not suited to be president, when you come right down to it. Huge amounts of time were spent by the Clintons obsessing over real or imagined enemies and how to get them. Byrne kept quiet about what he saw and knew until a federal subpoena and a later ruling by Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist made it okay for him to tell Ken Starr's prosecutors what he knew about Bill Clinton's false statements and alterations of truth. He wants to make sure that the Clintons never again are in a position of power to put America and its citizens at risk. Chapter 1. He starts with a morning in late summer 1995. The Clintons had been up late, arguing with each other, their loud voices, especially Hillary's, carrying far through the White House. The argument ended with a crash. Secret Service agents had to check that out, went into the location where they were arguing, and found a blue vase shattered on the floor. When the president came into the office around 9 the next morning, Gary saw that he had one black eye. This struck Gary as being very much not okay. He had trouble wrapping his wits around the fact that the Clintons could carry on this way. Didn't they realize that the vase could have hit its target? That the president could have fallen and hit his head on a corner of a desk? And that would have made for nothing for all the Secret Service protection provided by hundreds of loyal, dedicated officers. Chapter 2. Byrne's heritage was from Ireland and Lebanon. His family name had been changed somewhere along the line from O'Byrne to Byrne. He had a brother and two sisters growing up in a small town in Pennsylvania. His dad was an Air Force mechanic. Later, after the Vietnam War, they went to Newport News, Virginia, where his dad was trained in nuclear engineering. Gary had great difficulty in school and was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder and dyslexia. However, sports came easily to him. Chapter 3. After high school, he joined the Air Force in 1982 and went through basic training and got inculcated in the world of Air Force Security Police. He found out that he was very good with skills that come in handy during any kind of a fight. Excuse me. He served 13 months in Turkey and then was stationed in Langley, Virginia. He left the Air Force in 1986 and lived in Pennsylvania, working for Boeing from 1987 to 1991. He got married. Then he applied for and was accepted into the Secret Service Uniform Division. He went through that training, which was extensive. He talks about how a Secret Service Uniform Division officer has more arresting power than any other law enforcement officer or any other federal agency's agents, including the Secret Service agents. They don't need a warrant to make an arrest or invade someone's privacy. The back of his badge includes the words, "Worthy of Trust and Confidence." Chapter 4. He started work at the White House in July of 1991, working the fence detail, which gets to deal with quite a few unstable or downright crazy folks looking to somehow get in to see the president, and also the occasional person of ill intent who is either scouting for future attacks or up to other ill will. He related several experiences with both types of public, and one gets the idea that, yes, Virginia, there really are crazy people out there, And yes, there really are people who are trying to cause harm to our president or others. One incident involved a high-speed car chase after three obviously bad guys, which was called off by his superiors. Gary felt that timidity in the upper ranks served no good purpose. He spent several pages describing life guarding the elder President Bush and Mrs. Bush. He really respected the Bushes. He appreciated how both President Bush and Mrs. Bush treated the Secret Service staff and the permanent executive residence staff. Friendly, appreciative, considerate. And President Bush had a very strong work ethic. He thought it would be like that with every president. In 1992, the election campaign was in full swing. Chapter 5. In 1992, the election campaign was in full swing, and at a 1992 Clinton campaign rally, a man walked up to one of the Secret Service agents and told him that he was a sheriff's deputy and had a .45 pistol on his person and could take out the president, who was only 10 or 15 feet away at the time, and he said that no one had searched him when he arrived at the rally. And my comment, rather the comment of the summarizer, is that one incident was an eye-opener for me, as it indicated that at least part of the Secret Service coverage, quote-unquote, of the president was not serious, that it was more the appearance of protection rather than a no-nonsense provision of actual security, despite all the training and the numbers of agents and the big budget. End of my comment. Money was found, and portable metal detectors were obtained and employed at future campaign events. He relates talking with an Arkansas sheriff at a campaign event and asked about the latest rumors about the Clintons. The sheriff told him that everything said about the Clintons is true. He said that the Clintons are ruthless and that people in the media don't even know the half of it. He said he was sure that Clinton would be elected. Gary asked how he could be so sure, what with all the scandals, the allegations of affairs, bribery, and the sheriff said that it wouldn't matter, that the Clintons could spin shit into gold. Well, Byrne felt that was a very odd conversation. Once Gary was at the White House working a metal detector line, and a guy comes in, puts his hands in his pockets, and quietly says he has a gun. Gary grabbed his hands and kept them in his pockets, and a lady Secret Service Uniform Division officer aimed her pistol at the guy's eyeball, and that was that. It was much more difficult out at campaign events because the Clinton staffers wanted speed of getting people through the checkpoints, not security. Chapter 6. Byrne relates a few anecdotes of some of the more unprofessional staffers of the new Clinton administration, while acknowledging that some staffers were very professional. He relates a chance hallway discussion between the Secretary of Defense, Les Aspin, George Stephanopoulos, Advisor Rahm Emanuel, and others about an operation in Mogadishu, Somalia. The discussion basically was around limiting what equipment the military could bring with them so that they wouldn't look too militant. Later, on October the 3rd, 1993, a battle took place in Mogadishu between about 160 U.S. Army Rangers and a whole bunch of Somalis. Later, this was depicted in a book and a film called Black Hawk Down. According to Gary, if the Clinton administration executives had not interfered, the Army would not have suffered so many casualties and wouldn't have had to inflict so many casualties against their opponents and the civilians caught in the middle. He described a ceremony at the White House to give medals of honor to two soldiers killed during the fighting at Mogadishu. The father of one of the deceased soldiers became furious at the idea of being given the medal by President Clinton, who the father felt had avoided the draft during the Vietnam War. Gary felt the ceremony was simply a PR event to help hold down criticism about the events at Mogadishu. Chapter 7. This chapter includes several scenes giving examples of how Hillary handled herself and treated other people in the White House. Soon after taking over the White House, Hillary and her staff scheduled many events to restore relations with groups who might have gotten a bit ruffled during the campaign. These were often expensive galas, dinners, etc., Many tours of the White House were given at all hours of the day or night. The Clintons and their staff seemed not to realize that this all had to be paid for out of either the executive residence budget or the coffers of the Democratic Party. Some civilian rental companies had trouble getting paid and refused to do future events until they were paid. The reason Gary knew some of these details is because staff or Mrs. Clinton were shouting about them in the hallway. The Bush administration had upgraded the White House telecommunications system, and the Clintons upgraded it again, but somehow didn't think that it would cost anything, and were surprised when the bill came in, which led to more shouting from West Wing staffers, and the uniform division folks also learned some of the details from escorting the AT&T technicians around. The tech guys told the uniform division guys that the staffers suspected the Bush people had tapped the phones. Staffers would promise payments to various vendors, which were then delayed because the staffers had no clue as to where any payments would be coming from. As time went on, Hillary threw more and more intense tantrums, which were directed at anyone in range: staffers, Secret Service agents, Secret Service Uniform Division personnel, anyone except members of the public or VIPs. One such tantrum occurred on Tuesday, June 13, 1995. Hillary and the president came storming down the hall toward the Oval Office, agents in tow, and Hillary was screaming that the SSUD, Uniform Division, was out to sabotage their events and had fucked them. Very loud. Hillary and the president went into the office, and the tirade continued as she yelled at the president about the very people assigned to protect them. The president tried to calm her down and convince her that her desires for retribution against the SSUD particularly, and also the SS agents, was out of line. But she wouldn't accept that, even from him. That morning's tirade had been precipitated by a visit from a gay rights group led by an openly gay congressman. The First Lady's staff had prepared a memo about the group visiting the White House and had described them as HIV positive in bold letters, which was a violation of their right to privacy regarding their medical history. The Secret Service Uniform Division personnel, checking their bags, put on blue disposable gloves, which they do for any search of anyone's bags by regulation. But this time it was taken as a slap in the face by the members of the group, and it made headlines. Much of the upset of the group was actually over the Clintons promising more during the campaign than they were able to deliver, and also over the memo revealing their personal medical information. Yet who did Hillary target with her wrath? The Secret Service Uniform Division. Another incident involved several of Mrs. Clinton's staff who were upset over some very expensive invitations that had been produced by an unpaid intern because so much money was being spent on expensive events that there wasn't enough to have a paid staff member do it. And it turned out that the invitations had the wrong information on them. These invitations were going out to VIPs all over the planet, so they had to be redesigned and reprinted, all at vast expense. The staff were not concerned with the expense or how it had happened that an intern had been given the assignment and was not supervised. Their whole concern was over who was going to tell Hillary, knowing full well that the person communicating the fiasco would be in jeopardy of losing their job and ruining their career. This example is illustrative of how the people around Hillary were living in fear, and it resulted in them operating at greatly reduced effectiveness. Staff in the White House knew that Hillary verbally attacked her lawyer from Arkansas, Vince Foster, all the time, and that his life was miserable as a result. Foster eventually committed suicide, officially, although there were several facts connected to his death which didn't quite add up. Mrs. Clinton's chief of staff, Maggie Williams, pushed her way past a uniformed division guard who was on guard in front of Foster's office during the FBI investigation, and she removed boxes containing unknown material which was never seen again. There were verbal reports from law enforcement people that Foster's supposed suicide gun found at the scene didn't fire when the forensics people tried to fire it, and the gun had to be repaired before it would fire. That was odd. There were carpet fibers on his coat, although his supposed suicide happened in a park. Also odd. And the comment from CleanGov is, "Where is Lieutenant Columbo when you need him?" End of comment. Continuing with this chapter, in 1996, a House committee found out that the White House Office of Personnel and Security had requested over 900 illegal background checks on people of interest to the Clintons, many of them people who had been appointed by Reagan or Bush Sr. That process had begun sometime earlier when Mrs. Clinton wanted some of her Arkansas people to be appointed to the White House Travel Office. The only problem was there were already 7 people staffing that office. According to the FBI liaison officer, Gary Aldrich, who later wrote about it, Mrs. Clinton didn't care about destroying 7 good men, but only wanted her friends to have those jobs. The travel office personnel were persecuted by the FBI, the IRS, and the Secret Service, and were later prosecuted. Comment from CleanGov is, "That seems pretty extreme, really." End of comment. Another time, a new uniformed division officer told some other officers, as they were discussing events on their posts, that he had said good morning to Hillary, and she had told him to fuck himself. Another officer corroborated the story. A sergeant went up the chain of command with it, and it went to Clinton's chief of staff, Leon Panetta. The new agent got an apology for the actions of Hillary, but the apology didn't come from Hillary. Gary found Mr. Clinton friendly and charming with just about everyone except Hillary. It was impossible not to like him. However, Mrs. Clinton always seemed to be on guard, never relaxed, always standoffish. According to Gary, Mrs. Clinton always looked uncomfortable around her husband, except when in front of public or the media, etc., when they would appear to be the very affectionate couple, until everyone left, at which time the switch was turned off again. An agent told Gary that Hillary once threw a Bible at him, hitting him in the back of the head. When Hillary walked around the White House, an agent would walk ahead of the group, directing everyone else to disappear, often into a closet or nearby small room, because Hillary didn't want anyone else in the hallways when she was on the move, as if it were her personal home and not the place where many people worked on behalf of the First Family and of the country as a whole. This, quote, "disappear when I'm walking in the hall," unquote, protocol was even enforced when the first couple stayed at hotels. And that concludes the summary for chapters 1-7, and we're going to do the other chapters in the next summary.